So it's Friday again, and we're lucky to be joined once again by Dr. David Sorrell, our Director of Clinical Training. Welcome back, Dave. I hope you're keeping well.
Yes, good morning. I'm keeping very well and very isolated.
Yep, and we're continuing to have good news out of New Zealand, and next week we're dropping down to level 3 on the 4-level alert. So how do you see things changing next week, Dave, from an urgent care perspective as level 3 is introduced? Do you anticipate an increase of patients coming to the clinics, or do you think it'll stay that kind of quiet level for a wee while afterwards?
I think it will be busier, and it really depends where you work. Certainly some places haven't slowed down at all, and other places have become very quiet. And I've had experience of both those sides of things, that I work at 2 or 3 different workplaces at the moment, and some of them are very quiet and some of them are very busy. So I expect it will get busier as people start doing more and thinking it's going to be, you know, a much safer idea to check out that problem that's been continuing for the last 4 weeks, perhaps even.
That'll be interesting to see. I hope that the quieter clinics out there start to get increased footfall as a result of people being a bit more free. But then equally, I'm mindful of the fact that it's been through keeping people apart that we've managed to get New Zealand, leading the way in terms of world numbers and reduced spread. So it's a sort of a mixed feeling. I want urgent care clinics to get busy, but certainly I hope people, that the public at large, still keep their distance and still make sure we keep this thing under wraps. So we thought we'd get together again, Dave, and have a chat about a few things. And one of the many things that you do is you post little blogs and things to the Facebook page, the college Facebook page, things that you've read on Facebook or that you've seen on Twitter. And for anybody who doesn't check out the college Facebook page, it's definitely worth checking that out, because you post things that are relevant to urgent care, and you also put little comments on, and there's occasionally a few little question and answers in the comments section. And one of them you posted recently was an x-ray of a lateral of a wrist, and you said, what is this sign and what does it show? And it's a really cool x-ray, and it's something that we all need to know about. So do you want to tell us what it was and how does this sort of thing present?
So the x-ray shows a lunate dislocation, and it is usually called the spilled teacup sign, although some people call it the empty teacup sign. And it's where the lunate is dislocated or displaced volarly towards the palm, usually after a fall on an outstretched hand in a young person. It's usually quite high energy injury, and it's one not to miss. And the rest of the x-ray looks almost completely normal on the AP and slight. It's only really visible on the lateral, and that's because all the other carpal bones remain in their usual position. And so if you don't examine the lateral, you'll miss it. And you might call it something else, a sprained wrist or a potential scaphoid fracture. So it should be differentiated from the perilunate dislocation, which is something quite different. Where the lunate remains in place and the rest of the bones are displaced. Perilunate dislocations, again, are high injury, and the most common one is the transscaphoid perilunate dislocation, where it's fractured through the scaphoid to displace. So when you look at that, that's actually the true empty teacup sign. So the lunate looks in its normal position, but the rest of the bones are not located in there. Whereas the lunate dislocation, the lunate is tipped sideways. So that's why it's called the spilled teacup. So perilunate dislocation is an empty teacup, and a lunate dislocation is a spilled teacup. But they're both very important injuries that require immediate intervention and reduction. Closed reduction is exceptionally challenging, and maybe something that you don't attempt where you're working, or do attempt, depending on your experience and facilities. Probably something that I wouldn't attempt to reduce myself. The only one that I've been involved with required very good analgesia and extremely strong traction and compression by the orthopedic registrar at the time, who managed to pop it back in. But often they are reduced into the air.
And it's one of those ones where it's really useful to know what a normal lateral looks like. And in the place where I work, there's a normal lateral x-ray picture on the wall near the x-ray viewer. Because when you look at a normal lateral and then you look at a lunate dislocation, it's obvious. And you think, how could you miss that? But there are a number of reasons that you might miss it, particularly if the x-rays have been done, maybe not of the wrist, maybe you've done hand views, or maybe you've done scaphoid views. What would be some of the symptoms that you would maybe elicit from a patient that would make you think of a lunate dislocation prior to doing the x-ray?
After you've done the x-ray and you've had the history, that they're going to have pain around their hand, particularly on the volar or the palm. They're going to have possibly some median nerve signs, so some numbness on the palm and the thumb and the index finger. And it will be painful for them to extend their fingers fully. But of course, it may be very painful, and it may be very swollen, and it may be very difficult to examine. So a high index of suspicion. And as you say, when you look at the lateral wrist, you go radius, lunate, capitate, and that all three of them should line up. And it is good to keep that in your mind. And often you will sort of mistake the lunate for the pisiform or other another bone. So you have to have the anatomy kept very well in your mind.
And it's important, you mentioned the median nerve symptoms there. It's important not to put that down to like a neuropraxia without completely excluding the lunate dislocation. You've got to be very happy that that lunate is in the right place when they have those neurological symptoms, and not just say, well, you've got a swollen wrist, you've obviously got a little bit of neuropraxia, that will settle with time. So I'm very suspicious when anyone's got tingling, particularly in that median nerve, following that typical high energy fall. But yeah, it was a nice x-ray, so people should pop over to Facebook and have a look at that picture, which you got from Radiopedia, is that right?
Yes, Radiopedia has a very good Twitter feed, and so it sends a sort of a reminder through. It's like, I haven't seen one of those for a while. Let's have a look. One of those situations where this is more likely you're going to miss it is when somebody else has ordered the x-ray. So often we get patients that are referred by their GP for an x-ray, and then you're reviewing them after the x-ray. And certainly my practice is look at the x-ray, look at the patient, examine the patient, see where they're sore, do your other findings, and then re-look at the x-ray. It's very easy to be misled. So believe all the evidence and disbelieve all the evidence at the same time.
Yeah, there's a number of reasons why looking at somebody else's x-ray is always tricky, because one of the things that I try and do when I request an x-ray is to put all my examination findings that are relevant to what I'm suspecting on the form, and then that guides the radiologist when doing the report, so you can be more specific about what you're thinking and what the symptoms are, so that they will take that extra time to report that area. But if it's been a report, an x-ray request from somebody else that maybe hasn't put that information on, and you having a quick look at the x-ray and then a quick look at the patient, you that's one area that those Swiss cheese holes can line up and errors can happen. So you've almost got to think, yes, this person's had their x-ray done elsewhere or ordered by somebody else, but I'm going to start almost at the beginning again and go through my usual processes. So that's one area that something like this could slip through, isn't it?
Absolutely.
So moving on, you put another great blog on from the Don't Forget the Bubbles, which is a pediatric cooperative leading the way in pediatric kind of free open access medical education. And you put it up this week on the child with a limp. And this is a potentially very challenging presentation to urgent care. What did you learn from this blog, and what are your approaches to the limping child?
Well, yeah, I saw this pop up on their feed with some other very, very interesting pages. And so to remember what to look at, I really like their acronym Stop Limping, which lists all of the possible causes of the limping child. And some of them I hadn't even really considered. And it was linked to a PEM, pediatric emergency medicine blog of a similar nature, and they go through exactly the same things. Whenever I'm seeing a limping child, you don't want to have tunnel vision, but I'm looking to exclude septic arthritis of the hip. So it's always in the back of my mind. And we know that the most common is probably transient synovitis, but as it says in the blog, this is a diagnosis of exclusion. So they have to be well, they have to be afebrile, and everything else has to line up. I'm not sure that they all have acute respiratory history in the last couple of weeks, but then again, children tend to have acute respiratory illnesses every few weeks, so it doesn't tend to help too much. How you exclude all the important things can prove to be very challenging, because only a minority of them will be injury-based or even theoretically injury-based. And often people can decide that there has been an injury when perhaps there hasn't. And I always approach it as if there hasn't been an injury unless there's a nice, concise, clear history, because otherwise you become, very tunnel vision. And I certainly remember seeing two very memorable patients, both of which had osteomyelitis of the navicula. And that's not a very common presentation. And so when I saw the first one, it took me a day and a half to recognize it. And the second one I recognized immediately because I'd seen it before. And so those were both children that were limping. I think one of them had a fever and the other didn't on the initial presentation and then did later on. And they both had a history of, they'd had some kind of minor trauma, and they had localized tenderness of that bone, the navicula, and they were managed as inpatients with intravenous antibiotics. The problem, I guess, if there hasn't been an injury and you're considering the diagnosis, is often x-rays may be required. And I know that in Auckland, you can't do x-rays under POAC. So unless they have insurance, you can't actually get hip x-rays if there's no history of trauma, because it's not funded and you need pediatric permission to do x-rays under POAC in Auckland. I know that may be different in other places. And you have to decide, am I going to investigate here, or am I going to send them in so that they can have adequate, exclusion? So for a limping child where it's not at all clear and it seems to be coming from the hip, that's usually going to be a white cell count, an ESR, and a CRP. So together they tend to use that at Starship, and x-rays of the hip. And that's sometimes challenging to do in the community, but if you've got good systems set up, you could do that yourself and manage it rather conservatively if everything's normal.
Yeah, it's tricky dealing with kids and of certain ages, because there's a point at which you can't trust them. It's a bit like James Herriot in the veterinary world. You're going on stories from the parents and some clinical signs that you might find, but often a child might just be limpy and you can press them everywhere and they're not sore, and then an x-ray reveals a fracture. So you can't kind of trust your palpatory skills always, or the information that the patient's telling you. And like you were saying, the history of trauma, if it's witnessed and it's a clear history, that's great. But a number of times people come in and say they must have been on the trampoline, or they must have, been jumping on the bed. And when you dig down into it, there actually isn't a history of witnessed trauma. And I think that's a trap that we can fall into, is the it must have been, rather than the I was with my child on the trampoline we double bounced and they went ow, and I looked down and yeah, they were sore and limpy at that very moment, which is a much more reassuring history, isn't it?
Yes, and you know, on our stop limping, there is a pyomyositis, and of course, that very large influx of flu patients, and there are quite a few children who had influenza-induced myositis, and so of course that will make it difficult as well. But usually it's a bilateral sort of thigh calf pain, and so it's sure the child may be limping, but they're symmetrically limping and they're symmetrically uncomfortable. But again, you've got to remember the whole list to go through, because it's not a majority situation. There's lots of differentials to consider.
And some of them are an easy refer, like I guess a child who's unwell with fever and a limp is going to be a fairly easy referral. But excluding septic arthritis in urgent care, how do you sort of scale up to the investigations? Because when you look at the variety of things that can be done, from blood tests and aspirates and CT scans and MRI scans and the like, we've all got to think of septic arthritis. But if a child is limping but doesn't have a fever, would you be thinking, when would you be thinking of doing bloods, for example, in that sort of setting, or speaking to orthopedics? And how do you sort of try and juggle all these risks?
So I think I remember an orthopedic talk of the hip from the cradle to the grave. And really, if it's a Maori or Polynesian child who has a limp and a fever, then it's an automatic orthopedic referral, because there's a very high incidence of septic arthritis in those cases. So that's the first category. And then the second category is a mild limp, and they're able to wait there, and they're afebrile, and they seem very happy. And that's your spectrum. But you need to consider what your minimum investigations are, and can you get those investigations? So I have a low threshold for referring those with a really significant limp. And if they've got a fever, that's, you know, an absolute referral. I think we're very fortunate in Auckland that we can refer them straight to the Children's Emergency Department, and you know that they're going to work them up. You could, I guess, if you're super suspicious about a particular infection such as osteomyelitis, you could potentially talk to the pediatric orthopedic, but it depends where you work and what you have access to. So if you've got a very well child, I have arranged investigations such as blood tests, you know, full blood count, ESR and CRP, and review them the next day. But you've just got to make sure that you've got very safety netting advice. So, you know, if the child develops a fever, take them straight into the hospital. They must come back tomorrow, or at least phone review, I guess, in this current environment to discuss their blood tests. But it is it's a tricky decision, and a good examination, you know, lie them on their back and rotate their hips. And if their hip is really not moving as it should do, then they will definitely need radiology. And as I said, plain radiology in those without an injury is going to come at a cost. You may be fortunate enough to be able to discuss it with the pediatric service and be allowed to bill it to the DHB. But it is one of those little challenges.
So the blog is Don't Forget the Bubbles. And again, you link to it through the Facebook page. People can find it there, but they can also go to the don'tforgetthebubbles.com website. And in it, Stop Limping is the backronym that you can go down. There's a good graphic that shows that. But what I like about this blog is that it has broken it up into age groups, because obviously the hip of a 1 to 2 year old is very different to when you're getting into the, you know, the 8 to 10 year olds, for example. And the diagnosis sort of risks changes as kids age and the like. So it I like the way that they've laid it out in the different age groups, and then over tens with the Sufis and the like. So it's definitely worth checking that out. And it is a difficult, it can be a difficult consultation because more often than not, they're normal, but you don't want to miss any of the serious stuff. And I think the word you said there was safety netting. That's one of the most important things from an urgent care perspective, because you might just be seeing this kid once and you might do enough on day one to say this is looking like, you know, your child is well, they're not feverish, they are putting some weight on this, we've done an x-ray which is normal, but you've got to make sure that the parents know exactly when to when and how to seek further assistance. So another blog post that you put up, Dave, relates to evidence-based medicine, and that was from the St. Emlyn's blog. And it's never more important than at this point in time, where evidence is actually having a huge impact on a day-to-day basis on how a pandemic is being responded to. And indeed, this week we put up a chat with Josh Russell from the Journal of Urgent Care Medicine on a paper that they did in urgent care in the States, which looked at the use of chest x-rays in ambulatory patients and how essentially they couldn't be reassured by a normal chest x-ray in their COVID patients. So that was a great example of how evidence has been contributed to this fight on COVID. But this blog post was on the need for evidence-based medicine more than ever during a pandemic. So what were your thoughts when reading this blog?
So it's a very interesting blog or paper or article on chest x-rays. And, you know, when you read it, what you realize is that chest x-ray is very unhelpful. And we know that the Chinese papers reported that CT is very sensitive. But, of course, all these come at a risk of contamination and spreading infection. And so it's kind of reassuring, as in to some extent in our environment, that we should not be ordering chest x-rays in these patients, that we should be doing viral swabs and then working out how sick they are. Are they mild, in which case why do you need a chest x-ray? And antibiotics certainly aren't going to help if they've got COVID pneumonia in most instances. And if they have and they've got, you know, a significant pneumonia, they're going to need to be in hospital for supportive care, oxygen, and maybe ICU. So it's to some extent reassuring, saying, right, we don't need to try and organise chest x-rays on our COVID patients. And I know, and that's changed, you know, what we did last year is if we thought the patient was sick, we would arrange a chest x-ray under the primary options and DHB funding. And we've reversed what we do, that we've done a full 180, I guess, and saying we'll assess them clinically. How do they look? What are their observations like? Do the viral swab, or maybe you're reviewing post-viral swab, but we're not going to be doing chest x-rays on these patients in our environment, that we're going to be reserving that for the hospital environment, because from the looks of this thing, the chest x-ray is going to be very difficult to interpret. So 58.3% of the patients had normal or mildly, so 58.3% normal and 89% mildly abnormal. So you're not going to get your answer from the chest x-ray. And so you don't need to do your chest x-ray. You're going to assess them and see how they are. Are they hypoxic? Are they short of breath? Are they unwell? And that's back to good old-fashioned medicine, I guess, and perhaps we're going to get better clinical skills, although doing your clinical examination in full PPE does have its own challenges.
But it is important, isn't it, that the term evidence-based medicine really sums it up in those three words. We have to practice what has been proven to work, and I think in this pandemic the evidence is coming out very quickly because it's a case of need, but often we're, you know, appendicitis has been happening for an awful long time, and the various ways in which those are worked up and assessed changes as new evidence comes out in terms of, you know, what sort of clinical scoring could you use, what sort of imaging can help, etc. And so keeping up to date with the latest evidence is important, whether this is a pandemic or whether it's you know, old-fashioned medical complaints. And I think the reason I like your posts on the Facebook there, and we put similar things through Twitter, and one of the purposes of this podcast is to help disseminate that information with our listeners. So you've put up posts today, or this week rather, from Radiopedia, from Don't Forget the Bubbles, and the St. Emlyn's blog. Do you have any other evidence-based medicine kind of sources that you regularly go to that you think people should maybe have bookmarked or followed as a sort of a means of getting some of this distilled evidence-based medicine on a sort of a weekly basis?
Well, yeah. So for the COVID, I'm also a member of the COVID Doctors of New Zealand Facebook group. And they, you have to be invited to this group, but they regularly put up posts from around the COVID network of free open access medical information. And their resources come from a lot of different places. Obviously, I Am Reasoning is for those who've got plenty of time on their hands and want to look in depth at a lot of evidence-based medicine, and they've been doing a lot of live blogs and virtual webinars and CME events over the last week. I haven't had the time to actually look at all of that stuff. The Free Open Access Medical Emergency Medicine Twitter page is very good for putting it in, but We are drowned in information, and what I would say at the moment is the lack of evidence-based medicine. There is a paucity of good evidence-based medicine, which some might say is good or bad. I think it's good, because what it's saying is there is a lack of evidence of what to do other than supportive care. There's no studies that have strongly come out saying you should do this for your COVID cases, that all these supposed therapies are still under investigation, so we should hold fast and wait for the evidence to come forward rather than ourselves to decide we're going to use high dose vitamin C or hydrochloroquine or zinc, or all these cocktails that come from overseas are what you could almost call hope-based medicine, as they talk on the blog, or eminence-based medicine, but not necessarily evidence-based medicine. I think we're still watching and waiting, and never has science been under such pressure since the AIDS epidemic, I guess, to look for answers. So it's an interesting time, and there's a lot to read.
And that goes, so whether you split this into COVID or medicine in general, evidence-based medicine is obviously important, but there is a vast amount of stuff out there, and you can, around all topics, you can find lots of conflicting information, and it's quite good to make sure you try and stick to reputable sources where possible. And certainly during the pandemic, there are links through the CDC and through the Ministry of Health, and there are groups like you mentioned on Facebook that have you know, specialists who are bringing all of this together, because you don't want to believe everything you read. I think certainly the first 10 EM blog is worth mentioning. We've had Justin on the podcast a couple of times, who's a Canadian emergency physician. His blogs at first 10 EM do look predominantly at emergency medicine, but some of that definitely trickles down into what we do. And he goes through the evidence in great depth and comes to a conclusion. And sometimes it's different to what you might have expected. So people like him, who have done the hard yards and condensed it all, is very important. So it's certainly something I'd encourage everybody to take the time to do. And you can do it through all of these online platforms and through podcasts and whatever works for you. But keeping abreast of what's going on in medicine right now with COVID is just an example of how important it is throughout medicine that we don't just practice the same thing all the time without checking that it is still current. And Yep. So that's another good blog post to read through through the Facebook. So thank you, Dave. We're coming up to half an hour now, so we will call that an end. Thank you for again providing this through Facebook and for joining us to chat about it. Next week we might try and get together again and go through some other things. Do you have any planned posts coming up? Any little teasers that you are able to tell people?
Yes, let me go back and I'll just find out where we're at. Just give me a second. So coming up in the next few days, oops.
I need to insert some drum rolls here to raise the tension.
I've clicked across. I'm just bringing up what I've scheduled. So I have scheduled for the next 2 weeks. So we've got a blog coming up tomorrow on how to pimp your PPE to make pediatric patients less scared. We have a new Don't Forget the Bubble series on wound closure and wound management, which is very good. And then we've got some GP Peds blogs as well on dealing with COVID, some interesting aspects there. And then I'll have a look for some more radiology signs. I've got a few things lined up over the next 10 days.
Great. So keep a lookout for those, and we'll be in touch with Dave again in the near future. So thank you, Dave, for joining us today, and keep well next week when we go to level 3, and we will see you anon.
Okay. Have a good day.
Thanks for listening.